Well, once again, I thoroughly enjoyed being here. What I plan to do this afternoon is to talk about what I see, at least, as some broad trends going on in American preaching, and then leave some time for some conversation, because I'd really like to know, both of you have questions, but also if you have maybe even alternative ideas about how you see it in your own practice. About a year ago, in my basic preaching class, a piece of pedagogy blew up in my face. For the last 10 years or so, I have used in my basic preaching class the tape recording of what I consider to be a remarkable sermon. It's by one of America's finest practitioners of preaching, and I use it as a kind of an example, a representative example of innovative sermon form. What this particular sermon does is it develops its theme, and then it ends with four gem-like narratives, each one of them ratcheting the sermon forward in a perceptible way toward a magnificent and stunning conclusion. Every time I've used it before, students not only learn from the sermon, they marvel at its craft. Well, not this time. This particular class was bored by the sermon, especially all of the stories at the end. There were too many stories, said one of the students. Another one, missing, I think, some of the subtleties of the sermon, said, "Yeah, why did he tell all of those stories? I mean, like, I got it after the first one." Now, it may have been simply the chemistry of this particular class, but I wondered, as I was trotting out this example of a tour de force of narrative preaching in front of the 20-somethings in my class, if I was not watching the canary die in the coal mine. For the past 50 years, some form of narrative preaching has been the method of choice for the American pulpit, especially in the main line. But recently, narrative preaching has begun to take on water. It is beginning to be roundly criticized from all theological directions, and it may be that we are in one of those periods when preaching, which goes through a nervous breakdown about every 50 years, is in the middle of another one of those breakdowns, when the style and forms that have been reliable and dependable in the past suddenly are no longer connecting with the culture. In order to look at that, what's happening to narrative preaching, why is it happening, and what may be emerging, I want to back up and ask ourselves, historically, how did we get to this particular moment in the history and culture of American preaching? And in order to do that, I want to unwind the yarn all the way back to the 1950s. In the early 1950s, right after World War II and the Korean conflict, the American pulpit was essentially in a didactic mode. The didactic mode revealed the fact that for most congregations and most preachers, the Christian faith was a stable and somewhat finished operation, and what remained for us to do was to teach it. And the way that we taught it was to construct sermons which had a number of didactic themes or points. We caricature this as three points and a poem. But as a matter of fact, a good bit of the preaching that comes out of the 50s did have a kind of symmetrical, point-shaped structure. But preachers sensed that something was wrong. The culture had shifted, and the Christian faith may have been stable for the preacher, but it was not stable for the post-World War II generation. And although they filled up our churches in the 50s, we sensed that they were not listening to our sermons. Something was wrong. And the kind of emergency distress signal went out to teachers of homiletics, this isn't working. And there emerged in response to the crisis of the early 50s what has come to be called the new homiletic. The first robin of spring, I think, came in 1958 when a young Lutheran professor of preaching by the name of H. Grady Davis published a book called Design for Preaching. Design for Preaching. And what Davis said in this really simple textbook was, do not think of the centerpiece of the sermon as an argument to be propounded. Think of it instead as an acorn that grows into an oak tree. For that, you get tenure? Well, notice what Davis had done. He had changed our metaphor. Instead of simply thinking of a sermon as ideas to be argued, he said, think of the centerpiece of a sermon in more organic and dynamic terms. Think of the sermon structure as growing fluidly out of a main theme. And suddenly, movement and dynamism were injected into the homiletical imagination. But the real blow came in 1971, when a relatively unknown teacher of preaching by the name of Fred B. Craddock almost self-published a book called As One Without Authority. It is, in my view, the most important recent monograph in our homiletical literary tradition. And it is one, As One Without Authority, what Craddock asked was, why is it that the sermons of responsible, imaginative, and creative ministers fall so flat in the ears of listeners? He did not ask, why do the sermons of irresponsible preachers fall flat? There's no mystery in that. But how come creative, intelligent, and imaginative preachers are boring their congregations? And he came to the conclusion that the reason was a difference between the logic employed in the study versus the logic employed in the pulpit. Think of it, he said. In the study, there sits the minister. In front of her is a blank tablet or computer screen, a few open commentaries, and the Bible turned to the text for next Sunday. She doesn't know what she's going to say, so she goes on a kind of sleuthing expedition. She knocks on doors and rattles windows. She does a little word study. She explores a few commentaries, looking for something. It gets to be Tuesday, nothing. Wednesday, nothing. Thursday afternoon, 2:15, suddenly, aha, yes, at last, that will preach. Notice that the "that will preach" has come at the end of a process of discovery. Then, said Craddock, she is taught to turn that logic on its head, to stand in the pulpit and to take the results of her discovery and transform it into the thesis statement for the morning. My thesis is, and then to propound it in 3 points. Inductive in the study, deductive in the pulpit. What would happen, said Craddock, if you brought a stylized version of induction into the pulpit and engaged the congregation in a replication of the event of discovery that had produced the insight for the preacher to begin with? When he wrote that book, the homiletical world tilted on its axis, and a cottage industry of narrative, inductive, fluid, metaphorical, image-rich books on preaching came out. I'm thinking about Eugene Lowry, The Homiletical Plot, David Buttrick, Homiletic Moves and Structures, Patricia Wilson Kastner, Imagery in Preaching, Thomas Long, The Preaching and the Literary Forms of the Bible. Suddenly the world was filled with narrative approaches, and in 1978, Craddock published another book called Overhearing the Gospel, and it was based on a line from Soren Kierkegaard. The line was this: there is no lack of information in the Christian land. What is lacking is something else, and that cannot be communicated directly, but only indirectly. Now, Kierkegaard is talking about Denmark in the early 1800s. Denmark was officially, by state law, a Christian land. Even the dogs and cats and chickens were Christians. And Kierkegaard was saying, there's no lack of information in Denmark. No lack of information in a Christian land. What's lacking is something else: existential engagement with the gospel. And you can't get at that directly. You have to get at that through parable and paradox and indirection. But Craddock heard that as a beautiful description of America in the 1970s. We've been Sunday schooled to death. Congregations have been taught the gospel until they're up to here with it. There is no lack of information in a Christian land. What is lacking is something else. And you can't get at that directly, point one, point two, point three. You can get at it only indirectly through induction. Now, St. Augustine wrote the first homiletical book that we know anything about. It's called Book Four of On Christian Doctrine. And in Book Four, he asks, what's the purpose of a sermon? And he steals a line from Cicero to define the purpose of a sermon and baptizes it. And the line is this: the purpose of a sermon is to teach, to move, and to persuade. To teach, to delight, and to persuade. And what Augustine meant by that was, our first responsibility is to teach the content of the Christian faith. But you can teach so pedantically that it can numb congregations senseless. And so we are to teach with delight and imagination that infuses the heart and the soul. And when you do teach delightfully, it is persuasive, not in the way that Billy Graham means, but in ethical terms. It opens up a way of being in the world that one could not have seen before. I sometimes say to students that what Augustine wanted to hear at the door after preaching a sermon was not, I liked your little talk, but I learned something this morning. I was moved by what you said, and I intend to do something about it. To teach, to delight, to persuade. But Augustine was also unintentionally describing seasons in the history of preaching. There have been times when the pulpit has sprung forth as a teaching device, the Reformation, for one. There are times when the pulpit has sprung forth as an ethical instrument, the civil rights era, for one. But for the last 50 years, we have been, under the guidance of Craddock and others, in the season of delight. Congregations had been taught. They had understood the morals of the Christian life. What was lacking was a sense of imagination and delight. This, by the way, is the third time in the history of American preaching that we have moved into the narrative moment, into the season of delight. The first was in the early 1800s when the Puritan style of preaching broke down. And under the influence of Methodist itinerants and African-American preachers, narrative began to be infused into the American stream of preaching. The second was right after the Civil War, when people like Henry Ward Beecher and later T. DeWitt Talmage began to almost invent the modern sermon illustration as they preached to displaced farm boys and girls who had moved into the cities during the Industrial Revolution. And they found, as they told stories in the pulpit, that people leaned forward. And in our own period. Now, what holds together those three periods? Why has narrative suddenly emerged in our own time, right after the Civil War and in the early 1800s, as the method of choice in the American pulpit? I think it is because in all three of these periods, we are experiencing in our religious culture a suppression of religious experience. The Puritans had a kind of stranglehold on religious affection, as they called it, and narrative, under the hands of Methodists and African Americans, was a revolt against the Puritan stranglehold. After the Civil War, Puritans were out of the way, but Calvinists were in the catbird seat theologically in America, and Calvinism was a kind of the official American theology. It too suppressed religious experiences, and the Emersonians and the Henry Ward Beechers revolted with narrative. In our own time, it's not Puritanism and Calvinism that has suppressed religious experience. It's the flat technological age in which we live that drives religious affections and experience underground. When I was a middler in seminary, I spent a summer in a North Carolina town as a student pastor. And my supervising pastor asked me to sort of take pastoral care charge of a half a dozen families or so as a learning experience in the congregation. One of these families had several children, the youngest of whom was a victim of cerebral palsy. One afternoon, I was over visiting this house, and they invited me to stay for dinner. And I noticed that it was almost as if there was this circle of light in which the whole family existed, except for John, the youngest boy. He would stand literally and figuratively outside of the family circle, watching the rest of them. Another afternoon, I went to visit them, and only John's mother was at home. And after we had chatted for a while, she wanted to tell me about an experience she had had a few days before. She said she had been seated in the same room. It was late in the afternoon. The light was dying. She was reading or knitting. I can't remember which now. And her son, John, was down at the end of the hallway in the shadows watching her. She said, "I felt a shift in the room. I looked down the hallway, and what she said was, I saw Jesus with his arm around John. I looked away, I looked back, and there was only John. But for the first time since he was born, I saw John as already healed in the power of God." Now, I don't know what happened there, but I do know the two different things that each of us did with that. She turned that into ethics. If you go to that town today, you will find programs in the public schools and in the community that she established and put in place because of that visionary experience, programs to help kids like her son, John. I had just had a quarter of CPE. And what I did, fortunately, silently and to myself, was I said, "This woman is feeling so guilty about her relationship with her son, she is projecting it through the symbol system of the Christian faith." Notice what I'm doing. I'm taking an experience that she felt it necessary to describe theologically, and I am reducing it to psychology so that I can manipulate it on the chessboard of manageability. And if her minister does that, think what the culture does to erode confidence in our religious experience. Peter Berger, sociologist of religion, says, "Either people today do not have as many experiences of God as they used to, or they have just as many experiences as they have always had, but they hide them or deny them, even to themselves, because they are delegitimated by the vocabulary of the culture." Now, look, I think there was something psychological going on there, but I think we need to be multilingual to describe it. And when we lose the theological vocabulary of description, it suppresses religious experience. And one of the ways that people revolt is to gravitate toward narrative, which preserves those experiences. Well, now we are in 2008, and narrative preaching is beginning to be critiqued from the right, the middle, and the left. What are the critics saying? What's wrong with narrative preaching? I've been a narrative preacher all of my ministry. I'm probably going to continue to be a narrative preacher. But what are they saying in criticism of my style? What's the critique of the prevailing narrative style? On the right, evangelicals were the last to warm up to narrative preaching, and they were the first to cool off to it. A beautiful critique of Craddock and me and others in the narrative school comes from James Thompson, recently retired at Abilene Christian College, in his book, Preaching Like Paul. What's wrong with narrative preaching, according to Jim Thompson? Well, it emphasizes form over theology, it is soft on doctrine, it is unclear on ethics, and it is notoriously weak at building up faith and the church. Other than that, it's fine. In other words, narrative preaching does not do what the evangelical world thinks that preaching ought to do most, and that is build up strong Christians in strong faith communities. The middle. A beautifully representative critic from the middle is Charles Campbell, recently of Columbia Theological Seminary, now of Duke University Divinity School, who wrote a well-argued book called Preaching Jesus, in which he said, "One of the problems with narrative preaching as it is practiced by most of us in the mainline churches is that we're telling the wrong stories. Instead of telling the story of Jesus, we are telling stories about our grandmothers and making quilts and raising flowers in the backyard. And these everyday examples are simply inferior to the gospel story and being used as substitutes for the gospel story. Other critics from the middle say, narrative preaching was fine when the Christian faith was in place. There is no lack of information in a Christian land. What is lacking? But now there is a lack of information, and it isn't a Christian land. And when we have theological amnesia in congregations, narrative preaching is simply titillating blank slates rather than deepening already formed and educated Christian commitment. That it works beautifully when it's evoking an emotional, affective response to information already there, but when the information isn't there, it's simply titillation and massaging. In some ways, the harshest critics are the most recent ones, and they are the ones that come from the left, people like John McClure and the late Lucy Atkinson Rose. They say about narrative preachers like me that not only are we irrelevant in the way that the evangelicals and the centrists have said, but that we also engage in an abuse of power. What? How can gentle narrative preaching be an abuse of power? Well, what they say is, when we tell those wonderful stories in our sermons, what we're actually asking of a congregation is that everybody present, regardless of social standing or status or circumstance, come and live in the house of this narrative. I don't care whether you're the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or whether you're a divorced single mom who cannot pay her rent. This is the experience I want you to have. And by filing off the differences among the real people who make up a congregation, we are engaging in coercion and an abuse of power. They also say that narrative preaching has a faulty theological assumption. The faulty theological assumption is that God is always accessible. That by telling stories about my gardening or telling stories about my teenage son playing the electric guitar, I am implying that every single quotidian moment in our lives is pregnant with the mystery of God in a way that is fully accessible to the hearer. That in a sense, narrative preaching becomes like the worst of praise music worship. It always assumes that you can march in a pair of chinos and an open collar right up into the Holy of Holies. The theologian Heinrichus Burkhoff said once, comparing the Old Testament understanding of Yahweh to the Canaanite religion of the Baals, that the Baals were always ready to give you good religious experiences. They were fertility gods, after all, and that's what fertility gods do. They give good religious experiences. If you want to have religious experience, go to the Temple of Baal. If you want one every week, go and join the Temple of Baal. But Berkhoff said, God does not always move us, and everything that moves us is not God. And the left accuses the narrative preacher of making affection, emotion, and accessibility a theological fetish. In addition to our theological critics, a philosophical critic has shown up on the scene. There is an article that is beginning to make the rounds in universities these days by a British philosopher by the name of Galen Strawson. And the title of his article is Against Narrativity. And here's what he argues. He says, there is this widespread thesis in a lot of fields. It's in literary criticism, it's in ethics, it's in sociology, it's in theology. And the assumption is that in order to be a human being, you have to have a story. And in order to be an ethical human being, you have to have a good story. Now, by the way, footnote, as a Christian, I actually accept those two theses. When I was baptized, I was given a narrative, the narrative of Jesus. I think to be human, you have to have a narrative. And in order to be an ethical human being, you have to have a good narrative. The story of Jesus has ethical implications, calls forth from me an ethic that I would not have. So yes, Dr. Strawson, I am one of those who subscribes to that thesis. He said, I know that there are people who subscribe to that thesis. I call them diachronics, people who live through time narratively. He said, I am not a diachronic, and there are plenty of people like me. I am an episodic. I am a series of present tenses. I do not have a past, he said, and I do not have a future. Now, he knows that he literally has a past. He was a little boy who fell out of a boat when he was 9. He remembers that. But that is not present to me, except in the sense that last Thursday's piano practice is present for the concert pianist on Saturday during the concert. It is totally absorbed into the present tense. Who am I? I am who I am in this instant. In this instant, I'm someone else. And in this instant, someone else. I don't have, and I don't want a story, and I am just as ethical as you are, says Strawson. Now, I've got a strong theological response to Strawson, but I think he has placed his finger on a phenomenon that we preachers are experiencing in the pulpit. We are preaching to many episodics. There is a kind of cultural ADD out there. People who experience life as fragmented, as a series of present tenses. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's a crisis for me as a preacher. Because like Eugene Lowry and Barbara Brown Taylor and others before me, notice what I am expecting on Sunday morning. I am expecting that the congregation will start listening at moment one and will carry through with me till the end of the sermon, moment 18 or whatever, and will have an aha at the end of the sermon that is cumulatively built on the narrative flow to get there. But what if they don't want to listen that way or don't know how to listen that way anymore? Well, you know what they will do? They will take my sermon and they will divide it into fragments. And they will pick their favorite fragment and turn it into a park bench and sit on it. And then at the door, they will say things like, I really loved it when you talked about going to the shopping mall. I went to the shopping mall last week. Now, I would like to suggest that there are some preachers in our culture who have figured this out. We are in the presence of some communicational, entrepreneurial, megachurch geniuses who have intuited this episodic communicational environment in which we live and have begun to craft their sermons accordingly. I have spent my whole career dancing on the grave of 3 points and a poem. Well, it's back, but it's 8 bullet points and a video clip now. And notice what 8 bullet points and a video clip does. It caters to the episodic imagination and listening style. You do not have to pull. They may be threaded together with a theme, but you don't have to follow the cumulative effect of 8 bullet points. You can pick the place where you want to listen. And the video clip gives you some visual stimulation to wrap around the episode of that particular piece of the sermon. Adam Hamilton at the Church of the Resurrection, United Methodist, Rick Warren at the Saddleback Community Church, are widely imitated preachers who have now moved to the episodic style of communication that our culture can listen to. Well, what am I going to do about it? Well, I'm chastened, I must say, by all of the criticisms. I'm chastened by the cultural success of the Adam Hamiltons and the Rick Warrens. I am chastened, but I am not convinced. The reason I'm not convinced is not because I like Tom Long's style of narrative preaching. I'm not convinced because I think the gospel is itself a narrative. And to capitulate entirely to episodic styles of preaching reinforces and exacerbates the episodic, fragmented character of a culture that does not have a story. And now I have an evangelistic task, not simply to give the content of the gospel, but to give the form of the gospel as well. I think people do need a story. I do not think they can create a story of their own. I think it is one of the gifts of the gospel to give a story. I'm thinking about Oliver Sacks, who visited the nursing home. And he visited the room of a man who had lost all of his long-term memory. He had been a sailor, but he could not remember what he did, who he was, who his family was. And when Sacks recognized that this was a man without a narrative, he asked the nuns who ran the nursing facility, "Do you think that he's lost his soul?" They became angry. They said, "No, watch him in chapel." And when Sacks went to chapel, he saw that the liturgy, telling the gospel story in liturgical and prayer language, became an external gift, and that this man fit into the liturgy like a hand to a glove. It was a story given to him that he could no longer manufacture for himself. Well, I'm that way too. I have been given a story I could not have manufactured for myself. And one of the functions of preaching to me is to gather me into that story which I have been given as a gift. But if I continue to preach in this kind of Lowry loop fashion, which assumes that people can track me from beginning to end, I will be confounded by the sabotage of the way our culture listens to sermons. So I am going to suggest that we stop preaching pure narrative. I'm going to suggest for myself, I'll put it that way, that I stop preaching pure narrative sermons structured as I normally have, and that I move to a new and modified structural form and intentionality. One way that I like to put it is, I have been preaching like the Gospel of Luke, one big long story from Luke to Acts. I now think that I am called to preach like the Gospel of Matthew. Have you noticed that the Gospel of Matthew is really structured like an old synagogue sermon? It's Haggadah Halakha. Haggadah is telling the story of Israel. Halakha is spelling out the ethical and doctrinal implications of the story of Israel. So that you've got Haggadah, the birth and baptism of Jesus, Halakha, the Sermon on the Mount. Haggadah, the healing stories of Jesus. Halakha, the sending out of the disciples. Rhythmic move back and forth between narration and teaching, ethical and doctrinal. How are we going to do that? Well, first of all, let's understand how narratives are now going to be used in sermons. They aren't simply delightful moments of aesthetic joy. They have now a strategic kind of purpose. The first strategic purpose that narratives will now have is that they become dress rehearsals for a skill that all Christians need, namely the skill of being able to discern that life is theologically infused, both with the distance of God and with the presence of God. We buried Grace Thomas not too many years ago in the cemetery of the First Baptist Church of Decatur, Georgia. You don't know Grace Thomas, but she was the fifth child of a Birmingham, Alabama streetcar conductor. She fell in love with a boy at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, moved to Atlanta to marry him, took a job as a secretary at the state capitol, and she became a full-time wife and a full-time secretary. She got interested at the state capitol in law and politics through her job as a secretary, and so she decided to enroll in Knight Law School in Atlanta. She enrolled in Atlanta Law School. She was now a full-time wife and mother, a full-time secretary, and a full-time law student. Finally, after a number of years as a law student, she graduated from law school and, to the relief of her family, was ready to move into the practice of law, but she said, "I've decided not to practice law. I'm going to run for political office." "Mama, which one?" Thinking she'd say school board or library board. "I'm going to run for governor of Georgia," she said. And she did. It was 1954. There were 9 candidates, 8 men and Grace Thomas. There were 9 candidates, but there was one issue. 1954. Brown versus the Board of Education. 8 candidates said this was an outrage and ought to be resisted by every decent citizen of Georgia. 1 candidate, Grace Thomas, said she thought it was the coming of justice. Her campaign slogan was, "Say grace at the polls." Not many people did. She ran dead last. Her family was glad she'd gotten it out of her system, but she hadn't. She ran for governor again in 1962, and the stakes were higher. Civil rights movement was catching traction, and death threats were made on her life. Her family traveled with her to try to protect her. One day, she gave a campaign speech in the little town of Louisville, Georgia. If you've ever been to Louisville, the centerpiece of Louisville is not a county courthouse or a war monument. It's an old slave market where human beings were bought and sold. And she gave her campaign speech under the canopy of the old slave market. And what she said was, "By the grace of God, this is over and gone, and a new creation has happened. It is time," she said, "for Georgians of all races to join hands and work together." Somebody in the little gaggle of farmers and merchants who had come to listen to her said, "Are you a communist?" She said, "No." "Well, where'd you get those blankety-blank ideas?" She pointed to the steeple of the First Baptist Church. She said, "I got them over there in Sunday school." The stories of the Christian faith had become, for Grace Thomas, lenses through which she could discern the presence of God moving and acting in the political life of a volatile situation in Georgia. Stories and sermons are dress rehearsals for seeing God in politics, seeing God in Walmart on a Thursday afternoon at 2:00. Second, I think we ought to be chastened in our storytelling because one of the uses of stories and sermons is that they become a part of the congregational canon. I don't mean that they become scripture, but they do become kind of scripture. And I am now putting this test on the stories that I tell in sermons. Would I want these stories to be included in the canon of this congregational's memories of what constitutes the shape and definition and substance of the Christian faith? When I was a boy, we worshiped in a church outside of Atlanta, kind of a country congregation, and one Sunday morning, in the middle of the sermon, the back door of the church swung open, and a man we had never seen before, a stranger, moved into the middle of our worship. We looked at him, he looked at us. Who was this guy? We were right by the Southern Railroad, and we thought maybe he had ridden the boxcar rails to come in. Or maybe he had hitchhiked down the Buford Highway, but there he was. It was in the middle of the sermon, and the preacher stopped for a minute as the man moved down the side aisle and watched him for a second. He watched the preacher, and then something turned in the man's face, and he bolted back down the aisle and out the door of the church, and he never showed up ever again. For weeks, though, the adults in the congregation would gather after services under the oak trees in the front yard and would discuss what had happened. And they finally came to a red clay Georgia farmer theological consensus. And it was not that a vagrant had interrupted our services. It was that we had failed a moral test, that God had given us a stranger, and we had not responded with the hospitality of Christ. Now, we didn't know at that point about the Didaskalia, the 4th century liturgical document that anticipated the very event that had happened to us. The Didaskalia asks, what would you do if you were having the Lord's Supper and a stranger comes in and there isn't enough food and there isn't room at the table? What would you do? Answer, you, O bishop, sit on the floor that there may be room at the table, for you yourself were once a stranger. But the farmers in our congregation intuited that ethical response, and that story of that moment when a stranger burst into our worship became a part of our canon and increased the ethical awareness of that country congregation. It's a good test for narratives in preaching. Would you want it included in the canon? Another more chastened use of narrative, I think, not only as dress rehearsal, not only as congregational canon, but we have the capacity in stories and sermons to remember those who cannot tell their own stories. We sometimes say when we're preaching, well, I know the text says that you could lose your life for your Christian witness, but of course we don't lose our lives for our Christian witness, and so what we do is we make that text metaphorical. But there are people in the world who are imperiled because of their Christian witness. And through narrative, I can bring them into the communion of saints gathered in this place. The theologian Rebecca Chopp tells about the Russian poet Anna Amakhnatova, who went every day to the prison in her city run by the old Soviet Union. Inside the prison were political prisoners. And she noticed that every day there were old Russian women outside the prison gates, and finally she got to know them gradually, and they were the mothers of the men who had been imprisoned. And finally, one of the mothers, when she realized that she was in the presence of a great poet, said to Anna Amakhnatova, "Can you testify to this?" And the poet said, "Yes, I can." And something like a smile passed over the mother's face. The people who don't have a voice, whose voice is not heard in our communion of saints, can come alive through narration. But I think when we tell stories, we now have to not only tell stories, but move outside the story and assume another voice, the voice of the teacher and the ethical reflector, so that we have this rhythm set up between the narration and the ethical and wisdom and doctrinal instruction. Don Browning, who just retired from the University of Chicago Divinity School, wrote a book a number of years ago called The Moral Context of Pastoral Care, and it's relevant to us in preaching, I think. What he said was, pastors of my generation were taught that when somebody comes to you for pastoral counseling, that what they are saying to you is, I'm in trouble. I can no longer manage my life. I know what I'm supposed to do, but I can't do it anymore. Will you help me? And what the pastor is supposed to do is to say to the person, in effect, okay, I can help you. In here, don't worry, there is no right or wrong. There's only total acceptance. And in the bathing atmosphere of grace, mercy, and total acceptance, the person can put together their life and get back out into the moral fray. Browning said that was great as long as it was clear what the expectations and demands of the moral fray were. But he said, you know, now people are coming to pastors and they aren't saying, I know what I'm supposed to do, I just can't do it. They're coming and saying, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't know what the shape of a moral life is. And Browning said to suspend the moral categories of right and wrong exacerbates the problem. Well, there is a sense in which pure narrative preaching suspends some of the categories of wisdom, discernment, ethical guidance, doctrinal instruction that are necessary for congregations to live competently the Christian life. To suspend the narrative altogether is to turn our sermons back into the old 50s didactic moralisms. To suspend the doctrinal and ethical categories is to leave our sermons incomprehensible to an episodic culture. The rhythm between narrative and not narrative. I think that's where we're going.